might as well get going. In case you didn't pick up your quiz 2, I have your quiz 2 up here for some of you that we should get it out for you. So you can pick that up after class. And if you haven't already noticed, all the exams are posted up online on their webpage already, but not the grades. It's going to take you a little while to grade 100 people with all the grades. Oops, you okay? Yeah. And but it's getting up there. If you noticed, who is in section 3? Section 3? Yes, I screwed up one of your questions, so you get points for that. So you can check that out. Section 3. There you go. And then, you know, all the PowerPoints are up there, so you can check those out. Okay, so that's that part. I just wanted to give you a little... Let me see if I can get this... Oh. Okay. You can just highlight that. So I just wanted to kind of show you what's coming out in the literature, because we have... Oh, well, we can go back, and I can go back to the webpage. Let me go back to the webpage real fast. There is this assignment now, lecture assignment, and it's also on your Canvas, so it should have opened up this morning, hopefully. And you can write it in your MS Word program or wherever you want, and then just cut and paste it into the box which allows you to put in the text. So what is this assignment? And to give you some ideas, well, this is part of the 10 points. This is not the extra credit stuff yet. This is just your assignment part. So it's to find a kind of a primary paper, so a primary scientific paper, and then answer these 8 questions, basically. And put that into text, cut and paste that, put it into Canvas, and you get some extra 10 points. Hopefully everybody gets 10 points in this, because it's relatively easy. But what it is also is to interest you in looking at primary literature, right, in PubMed or some other journal, and you can then distill that together and put it in some text of understanding that article. But the main point is to try to relay that in layman's terms, which is sometimes hard, right? Think about, you know, you can't just mention sodium potassium pump. They don't understand what that is, right? If somebody's never gone to college, right, for example. So our goal as college graduates, too, hopefully everybody's going to graduate somewhere down the line, and that you will be able to explain science to the general public. And people that might not have a science education, don't have the opportunity, for example, too, are to explain some finding that occurs in the news, and you're trying to explain it to somebody, right? And maybe they haven't never had a biology course or a science class, except for what they have experienced in high school or elementary school. So the idea is to write this in layman's terms. Right, and it's not too much, you know, less than 500 words. 300, okay, 400, okay, it doesn't have to be right at 500. But to pick something that interests you out there. Now you've had enough of comparative phys, there's a lot more that we haven't covered yet. But some articles, that's exciting to you. And so you can go to PubMed and find that. And if you haven't looked at Science Daily already, I'm sure everybody's just doing that every morning now. And, you know, they do a really good job of general write-ups. But don't just copy and paste something from Science Daily and put it in there. But it gets you stimulated about the interest that's kind of in that area, right? So it'll be kind of fun, I hope. Just to give you an idea. So, and you can also go to journals and find on their webpage the table of contents, and you can actually write in your email, and then every month or every issue that comes out of that journal, you will just get a list of the table of contents. Isn't that kind of cool? So let's say you're super interested in comparative physiology, right? And there's journals out there called Journal of Comparative Physiology. There's also journals of comparative biochemistry and physiology. There's journals of comparative biochemistry. Can you imagine those guys taking biochemistry this semester? Comparative biochemistry. But there are also journals like Journal of Neurophysiology. Then there's the Journal of Clinical Neurophysiology. Then there's journals of, you know, cardiac physiology, renal physiology, GI physiology, respiratory physiology, and they're all out from the American Society of American Physiological Society. So they're good peer-reviewed journal articles and could interest you a lot. So you might find them an interest. Also, remember I did mention something fun. If you got in all your spare time, I know you just live for physiology, but there are, you know, other departments on campus. Physiology, neuroscience, microimmunology, biochemistry. And if you go to their webpage, they have a list of seminars. And remember, you can go there and get free snacks, right? Free cookies usually. Physiology department, med school usually has some fruit too. So, you know, whatever that is, a 4 to 5, you want a little break. Maybe you have a class at 6 and you're still on campus. Go catch a seminar, right? And get a snack, free snack. Usually have free coffee too, but usually they have something else too, water. So go early, you get more snacks. That's the key of that one. So for example, this Journal of Neuroscience Letters, which is a journal that just allows short reports. Just to kind of give you an idea what's going on out there. This just came out yesterday. So, and you've heard some of these things. PMC, plasma membrane calcium pump, generally determined neuronal pathologies. So problems with the sodium, you know, the calcium pump in the plasma membranes and seeing what kind of pathologies exist when that's not working right. And then you see different mutations, hereditary deafness, survival strategies. Purkinje cells are in your cerebellum that give you coordination, for example. So maybe people that are discoordinated, some problems. But you see this whole issue is really on calcium regulation in neurons with different pumps. So maybe you're interested in something like that. I mean, this is pretty cool. They give you little graphic figures like this. So you can imagine if the calcium's not pumped out right in the dendrites or the cell body or the nerve terminal, what could happen, you know, to synaptic transmission. As you had every class, every section had a different question on kind of an autoimmune disease. Some of those were on the calcium channels presynaptically. Some of those were on the acetylcholine receptors postsynaptically, right? Those are really cool disorders. So I gave you a lot of information on some of those, and we're going to go over the exams in lab sections next week. So you go to your regular Monday classes, you know, labs, sections 1 through 3, and Wednesday, section 4 on Wednesday morning. We're going to go over the exam for your section, and then we're going to go over to the outreach center and look at some human tissues and things like that, and then do some activities as well, which is related to the content we're covering in sensory systems. But so I just want to give you an idea of what's out there, and that the things we cover in here are really pertinent. This, you know, just came out yesterday. Basically, here's a sodium-calcium exchanger in diabetes. So you get the idea that these are really cool. And then here's some neuroscience research, for example. This comes out of the Japanese Society of Neuroscience, and they publish their own journal, but anybody in the world can submit articles there. It's peer-reviewed, pretty stringent. Here's everything on the presynaptic active zone, molecules that are responsible for vesicle fusion and synaptic transmission, activity that, and here's Drosophila active zones, right? So activity in the Drosophila neuromuscular junction, for example, and how that can change synaptic structure. So some pretty cool things. Here's presynaptic calcium channels. So this issue is pretty much heavy on the synaptic transmission, but the title of the journal, Neuroscience Research, gives it away kind of some of that. Here's one on insect physiology, if you're interested in more of the entomology type of articles. And you might think, why would we be interested in insect physiology? Any ideas, generally? Insects, horrible things, right? Mosquitoes, you want to kill them. But what do they do for your ecology? Food source, right? You think about pollination of your fruit trees, right? And you need insects out there, but you might not want some other insects, invasive species, all kinds of things that are really interesting. And, you know, it all comes together. That point I'm trying to excite you to think about integrating all these things. Okay, so the assignment then is to find some of these wonderful journals that you're interested in, find a topic that you're interested in, and then distill that topic down to layman's terms. Now, the abstracts of the articles, don't cut and paste the abstract. These abstracts sometimes are too detailed too, right? But, you know, you want to invest in something that's interesting to you and maybe learn a little bit more about it. Okay, so that's kind of the goal here. Okay, does that sound good? Everybody know what we're doing? Yes? When's it due? I think it's the Thursday before you go to spring break. Thursday night. I didn't want to do it Friday night because I know you're probably on the road. So spring break gone. And so that Thursday night before spring break. It's all on Canvas. It should be open access now to post. Maybe you want to get it done tonight. You know, you just love physiology so much. Just go in and get it done. All right. I know. Sarcastic. So we're leaving off where we were before with the crayfish. And it's just so cool, right? Because you can just keep looking at it all day long. But there's something we wanted to talk about with that. And let's see if I can put this over here. Let's see which slide. There, we'll go over there. Okay. Where did we leave off? Okay, there was something else we hadn't really thought about yet, figuring this off. All right. Let's go here. Okay, so we're on this. What's this called again? In the crayfish, these are the two muscle fibers that are in the back of the crayfish. Remember this? On the back of the crayfish. So let's think this is the tail of the crayfish, right? This is it, and this is the tail down here. I know. Well, maybe we should go back to drawing. Okay, let's go back to this drawing. So in this case, this is the back of the crayfish. There's actually two of these fibers on each side, like this. Over here there's two, and over here there's two. So each segment has four of these muscle fibers on the hemi segment, and it's got those two. And remember, those two have special functions, right? One responds basically to that stretch and then shuts off. The other one responds tonically to the stretch and keeps firing. You could also call these dynamic and static sensitive neurons, okay? And remember, your muscles and your proprioception works the same way, right? We talked about that with your muscle spindle. A little bit different than these figures, and maybe it's just a little bit easier to visualize. Remember, if you, instead of giving a square pulse, if you gave a ramp, right, then you could see that firing during that ramp. That's a little bit easier to understand. So that's for the dynamic one, right? And if you gave that ramp at a more rapid, to the same location, then you got a higher firing frequency, right? So that's how that animal detects. Remember, that's a single neuron, and these are extracellular spikes, right? So your proprioceptors work the same way in your muscle spindles there as well. So the nuclear bag, the nuclear chain that we talked about. Well, here's the point, and just a thought process. So this was discovered back in the 60s, actually. If some of you have that textbook Eckert, this is what he actually worked on. He was from Bern, Switzerland. And he worked on this for many years, but also a lot of Swedish people worked on this. And guess which kind of people in Sweden worked on this? At the Karolinska Institute. What's the Karolinska Institute known for? They give out the Nobel Prize, right? So it's kind of interesting that they were working on this, because why? A simple system to understand mechanical transduction of sensory neurons, which is what? All your mechanosensory systems. How about blood pressure? How do you detect blood pressure? How do you detect, you know, the hair moving? How do you detect touch on your skin? It's all mechanoreceptors, right? How is it that they fire? What frequency do they fire at? How do they respond to that sensory stimulation? It's very hard to work on a Fresenian corpuscle in a mammalian preparation because it's so small. It's very hard to do that in your free endings of your skin because they're so small. This is a gigantic cell body. You can actually see it. We used to have a lab in 350 with it. It's actually on your old lab pages if you wanted to look through it. We teach it in the neurophys course, 446, and record from this. But many students around the world actually record from the MRO, muscle receptors. So if you're on the beach in the spring break, you're down in Florida, and somebody says, oh, God, finally I'm out of that animal phys course, and I'm taking a break, and you talk about experiments, and they might say, oh, yeah, but I really like that MRO experiment because it was so cool, then you'll know what they're talking about, right? So you talk the same language. Because you can just take a suction electrode around here, pull it up, and stretch that muscle fiber, and you only have two neurons, the sensory neurons that are going to fire. So you get different amplitude spikes from these two, and you can actually separate them out and record. But here's something why these people at Karolinska were so interested in this. And there's actually a book published just on the MRO receptors in the crayfish. Wow, right? So here's kind of something to think about. Why is it, if we stretch these muscle fibers at the same time, like that segment, why is it that that one stops? And why is it that this one's continually firing? What do you think could be the difference? This is what they asked. Because they wanted to understand, like our Purcinian corpuscle, when you touch, you feel it. Then it quits firing. You relieve it off, and it fires again for a short time. And then maybe why, if something touches you, you might feel it initially, but then you don't feel it anymore. Is it higher centers, or is it the primary sensory endings that might be different? So these are the kind of questions that they were asking. So anybody have some ideas? What would you think if your NIH is going to give you $1 million, or you got a chance to work at the Karolinska Institute for summer research in Stockholm, Sweden? Wouldn't that be cool? There's youth hostels there, too. You can stay in the youth hostel and then walk on over to Karolinska Institute and study there, do some research. Right? Wouldn't that be neat? Okay, so what would you think? What kind of experiments would you do? They're given unlimited resources. They probably have it there. What kind of experiments do you think you might conduct? Now, think back. I know you tried to have it, erase it from your memory, the exam, right? But remember those open response questions? How would you design an experiment? Hint, hint, you know, to do something, to like to measure these responses. What would you do to maybe determine this response? Many, many years ago, I think it's been 25 years ago, I taught a workshop, a neurophysiology workshop in Seoul, Korea. It was the first time they had an international IBRO workshop there, International Brain Research Organization. Japan helped fund me for this, actually. And the students' neurologists recorded from the MRO preparation. They were clinical neurologists, and one was a neurosurgeon guy. He was so fascinated with this, he wished he had had a class, a lab, when he was an undergraduate to do recordings. Now they have lots of labs, but that was actually the first time they had a workshop in neurophys, and it was kind of interesting. But they were really excited by this as well. So you get the idea. You know, you don't get to record these kind of things in a human so much. Really cool. And we went over this, and we had a whole discussion. Lots of soju, if anybody knows what soju is. And then we had really wild discussions over this topic. Anybody have an idea? What would you do? Experiment-wise? Soju helps your mind think about experiments. No? Caffeine, that's what we need. Any ideas? Exciting stuff. No? I know, you're shy. You don't want to be a nerd. Stick out. This is a nerd. This is a nerd group. We have to be nerdy, right? Okay. Maybe recording from these, right? First you might want to record, right? And you would figure out that one's dynamic, one's static, right? You get that recording. But why is it that one might shut off? These are muscle fibers. You pull on the muscle fiber. Stretches. How does this work? All right, the sensory endings are embedded in this muscle fiber. You stretch it. What are you activating? Stretch.
Activated ion.
Yep, there you go. Stretch activated ion channels. So they open up. Ions go down there. Concentration gradient, right? Electrochemical gradient. Graded depolarization. I'll give you some more hints. So they recorded with intracellular electrodes in this. This is why this is such a neat prep. This is about 500 microns in diameter. You can see it with your naked eye, but a little dissecting microscope makes it really nice. There is a little sheath around it, but basically you can put an intracellular electrode in there. That's what makes this prep really cool. Plus, the cell body is right here next to sensory endings. Remember, where is your cell body for your mechanosensory?
Dorsal ganglion,
way up there. And it's a ganglion full of a whole bunch of cell bodies. Which one of those cell bodies responds to that response? Very hard to figure out, right? So you can do all the mouse models you want. You'll spend your lifetime trying to figure out all this stuff. So this is really easy. Nice, easy preparation to work on. So they went intracellular electrodes, and they could see this is a graded response here. So graded, right? How many stretch-activated ion channels open? Graded. And then they found out if they start to record and stick their electrode down here, guess what happens right here? High, and on some of your exam questions, depends what section you're in, the big difference about getting responses was what's so unique about right here? High density voltage-gated sodium channels, which means the threshold is very low to initiate an action potential, right? So they recorded right here, and they found, whoa, all of a sudden the grade response gave an action potential, and then it traveled down, but it didn't travel back up because refractory period, right? And so Actually, this prep was one of the first preparations to look at the site of spike initiation. Now, that's additionally cool, right? Additionally cool. Because then you could look at all the other neurons, like your motor neurons in mammals, and understand, oh, how else did they do this? Not a tight patch, but a loose patch. It's like a tight patch, but it's a loose patch. You know, remember we talked about Bert Sachman and Erwin Nair, who got the Nobel Prize for patch clamp recordings, which was on some of your exams about reading the patch clamp. But they could take a loose patch, not real tight, and they could move it around, and they found right here is where they had the high density of sodium current that went in, and that then additionally documented that there was the high density of voltage-gated sodium channels, and that was the site of spike initiation. So this preparation has a lot of history to it because it taught the fundamentals of neuroscience, neurobiology, about action potential initiation. Okay, so now they can find out, and both preps were the same. That one or this one, both neurons, they would have a site of spike initiation, axon hillock, right here, boom, fire. But why is it that one would shut off after you continually stretch it? Are we getting the brain juices flowing? The glial lymph, right? Need more sleep, I know. Sleep deprivation is not good. Anybody hear about glial lymph before? Glial lymph? Glial lymph? This gal's going to get a Nobel Prize. I think she was, where was she from again? I think she was in Pennsylvania. She found out when you sleep, Bruce O'Hara, if anybody knows Bruce O'Hara, he studies circadian patterns in sleep. He's on sabbatical this year out in California, playing in sunny California. But he studies sleep, and he was so excited when this paper came out. You could hear him running down the halls. He was just like, oh, God, did you see this paper? Came out. This is so cool. Well, and then went to a neuroscience meeting, and she actually presented this at the neuroscience meeting. And there's like 1,000 people in this room. It's gigantic with these, you know, like 12 screens that are up so everybody can watch her PowerPoint. You could look at her up in the front, baby, with binoculars. But anyways, so she was talking about glial lymph, something that we should know about because it's really taking precedence. She's probably going to get a Nobel Prize. You'll hear about it, I'm sure. But what did she do? She was from, I think it's Denmark. She was from Denmark originally, so she left the university, I think from Pennsylvania, and went back to her home country because she was recruited back, because when she gets the Nobel Prize, it'll be from that country, right? And not the U.S. where she really described it all. But anyways, that's cool. So glial lymph, your lymph system, right? When blood goes through your capillary beds, like your skeletal muscle, it doesn't just all go through the veins and come back, right? It goes out through the capillary beds, goes into the muscle, extracellular fluid. How does it get back into your circulatory system? Through your lymph system, right? Through your lymph. And then it goes through your lymph nodes, checks for foreign bodies, your immune system. You see how all that works together? And then that dumps back into your vein before it goes back into your heart and mixes back with your blood. But they found out that there was a lymph system in the nervous system, which they never knew existed. And that is after the capillary bed, right, just like your skeletal muscle, fluid could come out and go between the neurons, extracellular fluid, and would be taken up on the venous side, just like the lymph system in your skeletal muscle, for example. Glial lymph, they call it. But what did it also do? They measured amyloid plaques that were in there, and it would wash out the amyloid plaques and go back in the bloodstream. And when those amyloid plaques get in the bloodstream, they'd be broken down. So how does this all relate? Anybody?
Alzheimer's.
Alzheimer's, right. And then if you think about Alzheimer's, it's more plaques that build up. So they wondered, are these the people, see college kids studying all night long? Not good, you're all going to get Alzheimer's. You can't remember for the exams. So actually, the more sleep that they were getting, and they were looking at this in mice, then more washing out of the amyloid plaques, and it'll go back in the bloodstream, and it'll decrease the amyloid plaques from building up. So what happens with a lot of Alzheimer's patients is they don't sleep well. They have problems with sleeping. So it just progressively, they think, adds to this and makes it much worse. So actually getting good sleep is a good point to wash out the amyloid plaques. Isn't that cool? That's really cool. That's why she's probably going to get the Nobel Prize. She found this by accident, by recording on the brain. She was looking at blood flow, and then she just noticed something weird at the different times that she was recording this. And she thought, this is really wild. And under anesthesia, then it kind of allowed more flow to go too. And then she wondered, is this different in different states of the animal, sleep versus awake? And then she found out and followed it up, and that's your glial lymph system. I know that was just off the tangent, but where were we going with this? There was something to this. How did we go off this? It related. We'll talk about that later, too. Okay. So, anyways, we have these stretch-activated ion channels there, right? And pulling on the muscle fiber. So why is it that one shuts down and one keeps going? More ideas now? Isn't it cool? Science is cool because you can find out new things. I think if you're first investigating this, it was actually some graduate students that were first figured this out. So what would you do? If you think pulling on it causes a stretching, and this is a muscle fiber, maybe there's some kind of relaxation, right? Think about that Parsinian corpuscle that we talked about, that onion layers, remember, and that sensory ending that's in that onion layer, and you pushed on it, those onion layers moved around and changed the deformation on the sensory ending, right? Maybe there's something that's changing on the sensory endings on that one versus this one. This is a muscle fiber. It can move, right, and contract. So if you stretch it, what might you think? That one versus this one. Could there be differences in the stiffness? Maybe it relaxes a little bit after you stretch it. Maybe it doesn't maintain that force on the sensory endings, right? Like that Parsinian corpuscle with the onions. So they designed some really cool experiments. They looked at the sarcomere banding pattern on that muscle fiber. They even did another weird experiment. They took little iron filings that they get, real small iron filings. They just scraped it off, you know, wild things you might do in the lab. And they sprinkled it on these muscle fibers, and they watched the particle distance between them. So when they stretched it, they were wondering, did it kind of relax? And would they change distance? Did the sarcomeres initially, you know, you're pulling on it, but could they relax and stretch out? And they found out there was no difference. They couldn't measure any difference in the stiffness or the relaxation of the muscle fiber. So now what do you think might happen? What would be your next experiment? They did all the experiments on the muscle, didn't see any differences on the force on the sensory endings. Next experiment, anybody? Starbucks on the way in and next time, Starbucks? Different type, maybe.
Different threshold.
So the idea was maybe the voltage-gated sodium channels here might be different. Maybe there's a different type, and we're on the right track because now we know it had probably be with the neuron. They found the take-home of this. They found a different distribution of potassium channels in that one compared to this one. And it caused, after they opened more these different types of potassium channels, would cause it to come back down and shut off the firing. So it was all about distributions and types of ion channels in that neuronal membrane. And it changes the difference. And guess what? They're looking for that in the muscle spindle of the mammalian preparations, but it's too hard to record from in those little endings that are only about a micron in diameter. So guess what? The word is, by inference, they're already inferring it probably behaves the same way. But has it been recorded? Not yet. Maybe I should make another bet sometime, but I better research that first to see if anybody does it. But nobody's claimed that $100 yet at the neuromuscular junction, intracellular recording, and mammalian prep, shape of the action potential. Nobody wants $100? Okay. Just thanks, spring break, with an extra $100 in your pocket. Okay. All right, so the idea is, it's just like lots of things that we've talked about. Why different shape action potentials in different neurons? The shapes of those action potentials are from the types of channels that are in the membrane, right? You could have a large action potential. You could have a wide action potential. The density and distributions of types of ion channels. So that's the take home from that. I know it was a tangent, lots of different things, but pertinent points. And glial lymph was way out there, but anyways. Okay, so yes, we love little crayfish. Okay, so let's think about receptive fields. And we're going to do some of this next week in the lab, a lab experiment on yourself, and maybe you've done some two-point discrimination before, but we'll talk more about that too. So receptive fields, for your sensory perception, for example, externally, when you look out there, right, you can only see so far, right? You can't see to the sides way out here, unless you were a chameleon, which have eyes that can move on each side independently, right? They have a better receptive fields because they can see out the whole place and move their eyes where we can't see around, right? So you kind of get the idea we're not the best visual animal. So receptive fields are no different than the visual field that you see, but also where you touch on your skin, right? So that particular neuron will sense that area on your skin. And you can actually record that on frog preps, for example, record on a nerve and touch around the skin and find out where that nerve fires. It's a really neat experiment. We used to do that too. And you have a receptive field on your hand. Now, why is it that you're more sensitive on your fingertips than, say, maybe up on your upper arm, for example? The density of the receptive field, right? And the density of the neurons. So we're going to see that in lab next week. We're going to work over that in lab as well. And these smaller receptive fields, the high density of receptors, they give you that sensitivity where you can be very fine touching. All right, and then we'll talk a little bit more about some of these other aspects, if my thing works here. There we go. Okay. It doesn't want to work. There we go. So another point that's really important is to understand this kind of figure, like with your touching on your skin, and you can activate that neuron more than you can the other two, right, on the sides. So the activity pattern of that one firing tells you exactly where that location is. What's kind of interesting is that in some systems, and we're going to talk more about it in a minute, that this neuron can activate inhibitor neurons that go to the ones next to them, can actually inhibit the ones on each side. Now, isn't that wild? Why might that be important? So you can localize where that stimulus is, right? Bilateral inhibition. So the key is that this was really quite interesting when it was first discovered. And let's just jump to that while we're talking about lateral inhibition. We'll jump ahead a little bit. I think it's up here. Oh, good God. Where is it? Okay. It's coming up. We'll come back to it. Just wait till we get to all this neat stuff. So what's really neat is this can happen inside of your retina. And we're going to come back to this in a minute. So in your retina, light comes in, activates these cells, and then it can activate the neurons that then send it out your optic nerve. You can actually inhibit neighboring cells so you can have that acuity of where that light or that image is coming in. Now, that's your retina or mammalian retina. But actually, this was first described in this wonderful critter, which I thought I had a picture of. There it is. Oh, such a beautiful thing. If you go up to Newport Aquarium, you can actually pick them up and handle them. The horseshoe crab, beautiful thing. It has wonderful eyes all around it. They're compound eyes, like insect eyes. Remember, it's not a real crustacean. It's more related to the arachnoid spiders than it is really a crustacean, but they call it a horseshoe crab because it looks like a horseshoe crab. It's an ancient critter found in the fossil record. But its eye is like this. It's quite amazing. Because you can stimulate with little fine fiber optics and stimulate just one omatidial structure. So these compound eyes are omatidia. We'll talk more about those. And you can actually hook a little electrode, like a hook electrode, around one of the nerves. So again, August Crowe's principle was used here because it was so easy to record from these preparations. You could actually separate these out with a little glass needles, and you can record from individual nerves. And they found if you shine a light on this, which isn't shown here yet about the complexity of this, that this one will fire, but it can actually inhibit its neighbors. And so they found that in the structure in here, which is not shown in this figure, okay? The key is it's not shown in this figure. And what they found from this complexity of network in the horseshoe crab led to the idea of lateral inhibition. So if they gave a, let's say, a dim white light right here, okay, a dim white light, and you record from these nerves, let's say three suction electrodes over here, and you're recording activity from all three of these, and you gave a brighter light to the one next to it, guess what happens to the activity where the dim light was coming through? It shuts off. Because wherever the stronger stimulus was, it inhibited its neighbors. That was really cool. They found this and the horseshoe crab at Woods Hole, Massachusetts, where that marine lab is. Dan Hartline. He got the Nobel Prize and vision because it was so fundamentally important in understanding that how these neurons could respond and you could increase the activity of this neuron and shut off the neighbors. How does that help in your retina? Remember, they couldn't record these in the mammalian retina. This opened up the idea of how our eyes work, how mammalian eyes work by recording in the horseshoe crab. Is that not cool? That's really cool. And then people began to, when electrophysiology was getting a little bit more advanced, you could actually record in the mammalian eye, the retina, and realize the same principles held true about lateral inhibition. So what does it do for you, do you think, lateral inhibition? What would you think it would do for you in your visual world, what you're seeing right now? Perfect. Like, so visual on the side. So what it does for us is it gives us very good edge contrast. You can see the edge of objects very well because of the lateral inhibition. So it gives you that ability to really see the contrast in that inhibition on the side. So it's very sharp for that. So you see how cool that is? Anybody taking immunology or stuff? No.
Is this the same process of how, like, technically we can see our nose, but our brain, like, blocks it out at all times?
That's a little different, but, you know, that's kind of a higher processing. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that's neat, because if you put your finger here, you can see it when you put your finger there. Mm-hmm. But if you look out, you're kind of not focusing, so some of it is the focus point mm-hmm. that you're looking at, and you don't see it all the time. But that reminds me of the Steve Martin movie. There was a crazy Steve Martin movie with that. But anyways, that's a little different with the focal point, but it's similar. Now, where were we going with this tangent?
Lateral inhibition.
Oh, yeah, immunology. Anybody taking virology and immunology? You taking that? No?
No, I have a question.
Oh, yeah, go for it. In the fluid in there, like little particles, and it gives you some weird night problems, right, with light. But also, if your cornea is not clear, it's got little problems up, like what is that called? Anybody working on some? I'm drawing a blank on the name. Oh, it's these little things that build up on your cornea, and sometimes they just scrape it off.
Cataracts.
Oh, cataracts, yes, thanks. And those can cause problems like that. Right. But anything that might be additional, like, you know, pushing on it could be a problem. But I don't know exactly, maybe that word. But some people have night blindness problems, right? Night blindness is actually a voltage-gated calcium channel mutation. And then they can't see right. Their neurons don't fire right. And it might be this lateral inhibition that's going on if it's a night blindness problem. But usually they just can't see well at night. But that's a good point, too. When we get to the mammalian retina, you know, where you see the images, remind me about dark and colors. We'll come back to it. Okay, horseshoe crab. I'll go off on that tangent. Immunology, neurology, anybody take a course that talks about horseshoe crabs? Do they talk about horseshoe crabs? No? Do you remember anything about it? No? Yes?
Something about the hemoglobin and horseshoe crabs, they milk them.
Uh-huh. So they did milk them for the hemoglobin. They have really interesting aspects. There's a whole interesting aspects about oxygen transport in invertebrates and the different types of hemoglobins they have. But there's something really important with horseshoe crabs. The old pictures in good immunology books give you some of that history. And there were piles of horseshoe crabs. I mean, like the size of a two-story building out by Woods Hole and out at the marine stations. And what they were doing was pulling blood out of them. And guess what? They had such a wonderful immune system that some of our early understanding of immunobiology, how your immune system works, came from horseshoe crabs. Because you could inject antigens into them and look at their immune system and how they develop antibodies. And so they actually were credited for understanding how our system works in immunology. It's phenomenal. And then you think about the lateral inhibition in the visual system too, and these ancient animals that are really just amazing. So I just, you know, get you excited about biology. It's really cool. But comparative physiology, you can do a lot with it. All right, we'll go back to where we were. Keep you in line with the chaos. Okay. Where were we? We got to get through all this. Oh, goodness gracious. Okay, we're here somewhere. All right, back to that creator, which would be really quite interesting. All right, so we got to lateral inhibition. We talked about the percinian corpuscle already. This is the idea, right? And that this is really quite important in your skin for deep pressure. These are the onion layers I've been talking about, so kind of understand that. That's common MCAT type of questions, deep PET questions, things like that, if you're studying for those. Again, that sensory endings, graded responses. And then what do you want to do here? Do you want a graded response from this sensory ending to travel all the way to dorsal root ganglion? No. So where do you think the voltage, high density voltage gated sodium channels are? Right here next to the sensory ending, right? So now we can initiate a spike in action potentials, myelination, jump, saltatory conduction speed, right? Okay, and they're small neurons, so you need the myelin, otherwise it'd have to be a bigger cell, right? All that kind of aspects. All right, so some other mechanosensories, and we can just kind of flip through this relatively quick because we're on the same ballpark. But like we talked about, the hair on you, or an insect flying, how it knows where the wind's coming, it processes all that information by bending of these hairs. So if you have sensory endings around the base of that hair, and it bends one direction, it can then fire, right? And some animals actually have the sensory ending up in the shaft of the hair. So when it bends one direction, what does it do? It stretches the membrane on one side, opens up stretch-activated ion channels. So like us, we have these endings around the base of our hair, around the muscles down there. But then in some animals, that sensory ending goes up into the shaft of the hair. And in other preparations, think about chemosensory. The sensory ending goes up the shaft and has chemosensory endings in there, and then that means the hair has to be porous enough. So there's pores in the hair to pick up olfactory responses, right? So it's kind of interesting to think about these things. Does a hair do both? Can it pick up olfaction and mechanosensory? Interesting questions that Vincent Dettier was interested in. Remember I talked about Vincent Dettier, to know a fly? He was the father of American neuroethology, actually, to address simple questions like this. So here's our skin with the sensory ending around there. We have free endings, too, that pick up pain reception, right? Capsaicin activates those. Light touch, deep touch. You got like five different types of mechanosensory endings in your skin to pick up different aspects. So it's pretty neat to think about if you're interested in these aspects and you wonder how they regenerate and regrow that skin after you cut it off, right? How it reconnects all back up and makes that sensory ending. So on a comparative aspect, there's so many interesting things that you could cover, but some of the key ones, like the statal lists, are really quite interesting. And they're in your crayfish preparations and in your lobster preparations are really a good one that people have studied for many years. So at the base of the antennae, these long antennae that stick out, on the base of them is this right here. And it's kind of interesting because it's relatively easy to study, easy to record from, to understand how you have equilibrium. So again, that August Crowe principle. So here are a bunch of sensory endings. So you see the cell bodies. They sit in this kind of mucus mass right here. And they got this little stone that sits on top of it. The statolith, you can call it. And it sits on there. So what's it going to be sensitive to? Gravity, right? Cool. Gravity. It's real. It's not fake. Real. Gravity. And so it pushes down on this. And so if the animal starts to go down, crawling down, it knows it's going downward. It has to change its locomotion. If it's going up, right? Or if it's tipped over, sideways, it knows it, you know, to rebalance itself. No different than you. So it's kind of interesting. You might wonder why NASA was interested in funding this research. What do you think? Gravity. What if you took away that sense and it couldn't have gravity? Would it be able to recompensate somehow? Does it now use vision for it? What if we took that out? Would the brain restructure? What happens to astronauts, cosmonauts that are in space for a long time, right? And then come back down. What if you're born in space, right? You're continuing on generations. So this is the reason NASA was quite interested in this. And so this is kind of fun to look at, but understanding that this is sensitive to gravity. If you want to do something really crazy to these, and you know, biologists do crazy things, every time they molt, the statolith grows. It adds more calcium to it and deposits. So they actually fed them iron filings, again, back to iron, when it was molting and adding to the statolith to it. And now you can do the things it's walking, and then all of a sudden you put a magnet above it. And it thinks it's like going to our magnet underneath it, and it would change its perception, right? Or a magnet to the side, and it would change its body position, but the ground hadn't changed at all. So you give them this altered perception, and then you see, can they compensate? Are they able to compensate? Anybody do a psychology experiment, your psychology classes, where they might have put the prism on you and you have to go around campus for the day or 2 days? No, they don't do these fun experiments anymore. Maybe it's probably because people hurt themselves. We used to do that in undergraduate years, and you'd see people walking. They had to have a partner, and they would go to the door to handle, like, to open it, and they would reach up too high or too low because the prism would alter it. But by the second day, or the end of the day, the first day, they would know to compensate and reach right for it, even though you see it, right? It's no different than, think of kind of primitive fishing, right? With a stick and hitting the fish. You look at it in the water, that fish isn't really where you think it is, right? You have to adjust, right? Trial and error, because the light shining through there deflects, right? So primitive people understood this really early, you know, to catch food, right, to survive. So your brain actually can restructure that in that altered perception as well. So it's a really neat psychology experience. But so they were interested in the restructuring of the nervous system in these animals with altered gravity sense. That's pretty cool to think about. And why is that so interesting? Well, we'll get to that about your ear in a little bit too. There's some other interesting aspects with hair cells. So there's a special hair cell that's a modified neuron, basically, that's really quite cool. So this is the fundamental picture, and this is on standardized exams too, so maybe you're interested in this. So this cell right here is a cell that can fire and release transmitter right here at the sensory ending, okay? At this ending. But it's kind of different, right? It doesn't have a big axon terminal. It's just a bulb down here at the end of this cell. Depending on which way, these are little fingers coming out of a single cell. So it's a single cell. And these little fingers are coming out of a single cell. So there's plasma membrane all over this, right? And if it bends one direction, it actually depolarizes the cell. If it bends the other direction, it hyperpolarizes that cell. Isn't that wild? That's wild, right? So if it goes that way, it knows that there's some movement of this cupola that's around it, and this is, again, like a gelatin mass. That's really cool. So this gelatin mass is here, and if the water pushes on it this way, it knows the fluid's going this direction, and it will fire. And now there's a second-order neuron right here that could receive the transmitter out of this ending, binds to receptors, if it's big enough, above a graded response, goes above threshold, and boom, you got an action potential. And it travels to the brain of the animal and tells the animal, hey, water's going across this way, or I'm swimming this fast, right? Because the water's coming over you like this. But no, I got a kind of something that's by me on the side, all of a sudden it disturbed my water when I'm swimming. Uh-oh, maybe it's a predator, right? So you get the idea. Very interesting animal. And so this is the lateral line in fish. They have this across the animal's side, and it can detect that fluid movement around it. What's really interesting about that, too, is it has this little bridge that goes across here like this, and it actually attaches these, and it's thought that that keeps the endings, those little fingers, you know, together. And that's pretty cool. Okay, so now let's look at the mammalian system. Your inner ear, okay? Your inner ear is really quite interesting. You have these semicircular canals in your head, and people have modeled this in physics models and all kinds of things that people have done. So inside of your skull, on the side of your head, over here behind your ear, you have these semicircular canals. They're filled with fluid. And when you move your head one direction, guess what happens to the fluid? It's going to move, right? So I know this is sometimes hard to visualize, but just think of it as a single pipe then. Okay, so we're going to have a single pipe. And I used to build a model. I left it at some high school somewhere. So I had a little pipe that was transparent in the plastic, clear. And we had one with closed ends on both sides. And we had another one with one end that had a little membrane. And this was closed on this side. And then we had another one with a membrane on this side and a membrane on this side. That was kind of cool, too, to think about. We'll come by why you think these three different models. And in the middle, we have like a feather glued to the base of this pipe, okay? And inside's fluid. Well, when you take that first pipe that's solid on both sides and you move it, what's going to happen? All the fluid moves together, right, with the pipe. So it doesn't really... Now, what if you had one, like the bottom one, where you have a membrane on both sides, and the fluid can move a little bit, right? This one can spin in, this one can go out. What's going to happen to that fluid? Right? It's going to move. As you move the pipe, the fluid wants to stay, right? At rest, stays at rest. Remember the physics stuff, right? All right. So you move that, but what's going to happen to the little feather? It's based on the pipe. You move the pipe, the feather moves, right? So that's how your inner ear works in the semicircular canals. That's how you detect where your head is when you're moving your head around, right? And you know if you get nauseous, right, seasickness, right, one way to do is close your eyes. That can help sometimes. But actually open your eyes and maybe look at a horizon is really good. But if you're in the open ocean, that's a real problem. So get another sensory perception or take some medication that dampens the whole thing. But this is really neat. That's filled with a fluid. So it's really no different than the lateral line in a fish. It's the same structure. Look at this. This is a single cell. It has a kinocilium, stereocilium, on a single cell. If it moves towards the kinocilium, it activates. If it moves away from the kinocilium, it inhibits. It's no different than the structure in the lateral line on the fish. That's pretty cool. But not only that, it detects all the different positions that you can move your head. Acceleration, movement, you know. But if you're continually moving, it's just not continually firing. There's something else that picks that up. And we'll talk about that in this next figure. Okay. There's that cupola, like we just talked about. It's the same as those pipes. And there's this beautiful stereocilia. And how you detect that, right? Fluid moving across there. So cool, right? Very cool. And now the next part. This is something different. This is, didn't show it. Maybe let's go back up. It's not shown in this figure. Horrible. Okay, I need another figure for this. But there are two structures in your brain, the sacculus and utriculus. These are in this region here. The sacculus and the utriculus. Just have to know generally. Don't know exactly. Sacculus and utriculus. What are they of? It's different than the semicircular canals, but they're still in the inner ear. They are like these things. They have a little stone on top of a gelatin mass. That then underneath that gelatin mass has these specialized hair cells with a kinocilium and stereocilium. So what does that little stone mass do? No different than the statolith and the lobster. It tells you gravity sensation. So if you hold your head this way, those are firing this direction, right? Hold your head that way, they're firing that direction. So it's no different than that lobster, and that's why the lobster prep was so neat, because they could record from the single neurons, these single neurons that were detecting that activity to understand how your inner ear works for static positions. That's pretty neat, right? So your ear works the same way as the statoliths for gravity sensation, knowing your position of your head, and then the semicircular canals are no different than the lateral line in the fish and the way that they function. So that's why that's so cool. And if you think about equilibrium sensitivity, that's really neat to pull it all together. You know, we got proprioceptors, right? We can tell where our limbs are. We can tell where our leg is raising or lowering. We can now tell where our head is if we put it sideways or if we're moving our head around, right? You get dizzy on the going around the merry-go-round, right? And you walk and you get off. Why is it that when you go on those, when you were kids, right? What's that thing called again where you spin around in the sandbox and all that stuff? You know, anybody remember? You probably did that when your kids torture each other.
Just call it merry-go-round.
Yeah, like the merry-go-round, you get off and you still can't walk. Why is it that you still are kind of dizzy? The fluid is still kind of moving around, right? And you haven't balanced. So how do they do this to find out? If you have an equilibrium problem, for example, it might be you're falling or tripping on the steps, right, when you're going up. They want to know if you have an equilibrium problem. How might they, a neurologist, test this? They put you on a plate, and they move that plate, and they see if you can balance it, right? Or if you're going up in an elevator sometimes real fast, elevators have a certain rate that they're not allowed to go any faster on, not like these amusement parks which torture you, right? But elevators go up, some people pass out in elevators. So you might, and you don't have to do anything with the person unless they're having a heart attack. Just let them sit down for a minute, get them out of the elevator is the best thing, right? And because the problem is that they've moved too fast and the semicircular canals are going, sometimes they actually get dizzy and pass out from that. They kind of faint from it. But there could be also problems with blood pressure, so we'll talk about that later. But these semicircular canals are still moving when you get off that Ferris wheel, and that's a problem. So how is another way to maybe move the fluid in your ear? Any ideas? Anybody ever scuba dive or go swimming? So have you ever scuba dived in cold water?
Yes.
What do you do to try to prevent cold water from getting in your ears? Pardon? Well, you could eat clothes with that, but if you went scuba diving in Carter Lake up here on the winter, that water's pretty cold. And if you get cold water in your ear, it can cause you to have an equilibrium problem. So actually, neurologists use this. They put cold water in one ear and not the other, or warm water in one ear and not the other, and you will have a standardized behavioral response to that. Because you're causing that fluid to move by convection currents, right? Temperature. Convection currents, and it causes that fluid to move, and now you're going to try to, your body thinks you're actually moving, so close your eyes and put the warm water in, and you're moving. Or cold water, and it causes a different convection current because your body temperature, right? So next time your significant other tells you to take a cold shower, you can say, no, I'll pass out in the shower, I don't want to do that, right? I learned that from physiology. I'm joking. Okay. So anyways, that can be a problem, and people do fall down in the shower. Right? Because why? Cold water maybe is in there. Or warm water. Or scuba divers actually can get visual problems, but also lose their total sense. And you hear these stories from scuba divers where they thought they were going to the surface, but they actually swam deeper in the water. And they ran out of oxygen and died. You know, the idea, their partner's with them, and they think, what on earth? This guy's swimming down. They're supposed to go up, but they're so confused. And they're pulling the other person like to go up, but they're going down. And some of them that been, you know, where they were actually pulled to go to the right direction said, no, why are you taking me to this, you know, down deeper? Well, when they finally surfaced, they realized, hey, something was wrong. They said, well, I thought you were going the opposite direction. Didn't know what was going on. That's why you also have your depth gauge, right? And you can tell which direction you're going. Because if you did have a problem with that, you read your compass or your depth gauge and you know which direction you're going to. And night diving, it can be really dangerous for people, especially getting water in the ears. So you get the idea how important that is in understanding. So you're integrating all this information, right? It's going to the vestibular nuclei in your brain. That's really quite cool. Your proprioception, your stylus, your semicircular canals, all that being integrated. So just think of a little tumor there, or some malfunction there, right? Some people are very dizzy all the time, and they have some problems, and they actually may have a miserable life because of this sickness that they're like. Being motion sick is horrible, right? But think about being motion sick all the time. Now, I can't tell the story of who it was, but there was a person that was on a basketball team at one time that actually fell down and hit their head, and they couldn't read anymore. Because they couldn't focus on their eyes. Just one fall in a practice tournament. And what happened? They thought, maybe she had a concussion. It wasn't a concussion. What was going on? Finally, they went to EMT, ear, nose, and throat specialist that checked the ear, did the ear test, and found out there's something wrong with this, but also that position moving. And they found out that that one hit, cause a little status cyst or those lifts to come off that mucous membrane, and it was loose. So they didn't have the position sense. They always thought they were in a different position. So part of them was telling them they're this way, and the other part of them was telling them they're this way, and it was confusing them, and they couldn't read, couldn't drive, had to have somebody take them around, had to get out of school for a while to get and they went over to Cardinal Hill here in Lexington, And actually, they have a certain position you got to put your head in for a long period of time to try to get those statoliths to re-heal again so you can actually get your position back. And it takes a long recovery. Can you imagine just falling one time or hitting your head? So when you get your test back, do not hit your head against the wall, okay? It could cause problems. All right. So, but you get the idea. These little changes can really be a problem. All right. So that's kind of neat to think about. All that integration going on. And when we look at the brains next week, we're going to look at the cerebellum. It's really quite cool. The cerebellum gives you that equilibrium sense of integrating all that so you know how your fingers move and everything else. Cerebellum is also destroyed with alcoholism. So when you see chronic alcoholics that can't walk straight, part of it is the cerebellum is degenerating, and part of that comes from vitamin deficiencies as well, but also that cerebellum is very sensitive to deformations and dysfunction, and we'll talk more about that later. But then think about all that ability. You raise your step on attack, right? And you feel that pain, and then what do? You raise your foot up, but if you raise that foot up and didn't coordinate all your muscles on the other side, what happens? You fall over, right? So think how fast that works. It's phenomenal. Your crayfish or crabs were used in understanding equilibrium senses and how fast you can reprocess. So in Marseille, France, there's this guy, Francois Clairac. He studied crabs that walk on a little ball that moves around. And what's really neat about crabs, I told you about their legs that you can pinch on them and they autotomize their leg, right? And they can regrow a new one, so like a lizard's tail. But what he would do is have them walking, and he would have EMG electrodes on it, video, high-speed video camera, and then have them walking very fast as that ball's moving, pinch their little leg on one of their legs, because the decapod, you know, 10 legs, but 8 help them walk, and the other two are the pinchers. And so they're going really fast, and this little ball is moving, pinch the leg, knock the leg off, and the animal would just stumble one stumble and be back crawling again with one leg off. How fast they could reset their whole equilibrium and their proprioception, taking off a leg, and then re-coordinating that whole motor command back again. That's pretty amazing. All right, so just to get you thinking about it. Hearing. I know we're jumping systems very quickly because there's a lot in a comparative physics course. But hearing, like what we were talking about, we're going to go back to the inner ear later on, but just talking about now other animals, how they can hear, how you hear. How are you hearing me? I know you probably don't want to hear me, but anyway, how are you hearing me? Sound waves, right? Sound waves moving in the air. So in a vacuum, do you hear sound? Remember your physics classes, right? So it's an issue, right? Because of the no particles moving won't relay that sound, right? So it's kind of interesting to think about. I know we would like a vacuum. But anyways, so sound waves going, traveling in the air, hitting a membrane, moving that membrane. We'll talk about how that works in you. But think of a fish in the water. How does it hear a sound or maybe feel a vibration in the water from another fish or a predator? Well, it has this large air sac called a swim bladder. So think of a large air sac inside your body. It's a big surface area, right? And if I was in fluid and there's some fluid moving against my body, and this air sac could pick it up, right? Because it's a big air sac. And if that air sac is connected to some bones, those bones relay the movement of that air sac, and now it knows that something's in the water next to it. This vibration's being picked up, hits the swim bladder, moving it to the bones, and now moving it into this organ that has sensory endings in it. So it picks up that movement. I don't want you to have to know every little detail about it, but it's the same idea that we just talked about, like with movement of the fluid in your inner ear. So this is how fish can pick up movements around them by having this large swim bladder that can pick up fine movements in that water and pick that up and relay it to the sensory systems inside their brain. Or those lateral lines that we talked about too. So you're seeing different ways that animals can pick up the environment around them. All right, so we can think about tympanic membranes are really quite interesting. Anybody ever pick up those little katydids outside, you know, in the springtime when they come out of the ground, they crawl up the tree, and they're making that horrible sound, right? And then they make that little structure like a little cocoon thing, and then they break out of it, and then they turn off to the insect that flies away, and you're left with that little shell. I'll bring some in sometime. Anyways, if you look at those, or a cockroach, next time you want to kill a cockroach, you know, step on it, but pick it up. you'll see something really interesting on it. On the cuticle are these little weird spots with a very thin cuticle. They're tympanic membranes. They're tympanic membranes on the cuticle of the animal. And inside the tympanic membrane is a structure that has sensory inducers embedded in it. So it can actually pick up the movements of the air around it. It's its ears, basically, this little tympanic membrane. So it's really quite amazing. But amphibians, reptiles also have this ability for tympanic membranes. You've probably seen pictures of frogs with that tympanic membrane on the side, that big, large membrane. Okay, so this, and like us. So I'm going to kind of go through this because we're going to talk more about it. Okay, so sound. You're hearing me. I know you want to hear the bell, but anyways. So the sound travels. Ears are really important for collecting sound in front of us. We don't hear well behind us, right? But that sound comes in, moves that little membrane, your tympanic membrane inside your ear, right? Moves that membrane. Doesn't go straight to the fluid, but what does it do? Hits the malacinchus stapes, the three smallest bones in your body, malacinchus stapes, and this middle ear, right? This is the middle, outer ear, middle, inner ear. The middle ear, this eustachian tube is hooked up to your throat. So when you have a cold or your throat's swollen, and this is maybe sealed up, you can't hear well, right? This is part of the problem. You try to clear it out because maybe pressure's building up in there, and the air is not moving. So if that's swollen or filled up with fluid, you have an ear infection, could be that you can't transduce well, you can't hear well, right? Because those bones are not moving well. So those three smallest bones, malacinchus stapes, named for what they look like, and then they hit a little membrane. And that little membrane on that side is the oval window. It's a membrane, okay? It's an oval window. Basically sets up, hits that fluid, and causes that fluid to move. Sets up that mechanical transduction. But remember that experiment I was telling you about with the pipes? The middle one had a window on one side and solid on this side. And the other one on the top had two solid ones. And the one on the bottom had two windows on the bottom. What happens on the one in the middle? We touch that membrane here, the fluid goes, but the other side's solid. So it dampens really quick, right? Now let's look at the bottom one. It has a membrane on both sides. Hit the side here, the fluid moves, and now this side can move, right? So you get the movement all the way through the pipe. It's the same here. There's another membrane down here, the round window, that allows that fluid to then relay and bounce out. So now that movement can go all the way through this inner ear. That inner ear is filled up with different fluids, and it's really quite interesting. If we took a cross section through there, this is what you see. Okay? So that tube goes all the way around, comes back from that first window, the oval window, coming up and then coming out the round window. What's really interesting is there's another structure on the inside. And this fluid is different between these two. What's really kind of neat is that this membrane, when that fluid moves here, it pushes on this membrane, and that pushes on this fluid. Isn't that wild? So now it's really going down the system of air to mechano to the membrane, to the fluid, to mechanic movement, and then back to the fluid, and then this little hinge right here. There's a little layer, little membrane called the tectorial membrane, and think of this membrane with little fingers in it. What if that membrane moves this way? It moves those little fingers one direction. And when it comes back, it moves them back the other way. But guess what those little things are that are attached to that? Those hairs that we talked about, those modified types of hair structures. So those hair structures, we don't have to memorize three rows and one row, but there's a really neat anatomy to the whole process. But those little hairs that we were talking about have a kinocilium and stericilium. So when that tectorial membrane moves one direction, it's moving towards the kinocilium or away from the kinocilium. So it's either exciting them or inhibiting them. That is very cool. That tectorial membrane goes, where is it? Yeah, goes all the way around that little snail-like structure called the cocula. And that's this cocular duct. And so when fluid hits that, it moves all the way around. And that little tectorial membrane, you see where it goes all the way around? Has those hairs all the way around so it can pick up that movement. What's really interesting, like we just showed you there, moving those hairs, right?
What's really cool is that the sound waves that come through, this structure is so well known now about where the different frequencies of sound that you're hearing, how that stimulates different parts of this pectoral membrane and those neurons that are underneath it. So this is what's referred to as tonotopic arrangement. It's a tonotopic arrangement, tone, sound, arrangement. And it can pick up high frequencies at the beginning and low frequencies down there. But what's really more interesting is those sensory nerves that come out of there. Think of these sensory nerves that come out. They're going into your brain. And they're organized in your brain. So they go to certain spots in your brain. And you could put an electrode in that part of the brain where those neurons are going, and you could give that particular sound. You're going to say, you should be hearing that high frequency sound. You should be hearing, those neurons should fire with a low frequency sound. The take home of this is that tonotopic arrangement out here is relayed to the same arrangement inside of the brain in the exact structures that are there. So it's no different than like your hand, knowing that you touch your fingers here, right? And that arrangement of your body is in your sensory cortex on your brain to know that where your fingers are or where your toe is. It's the same idea on the pectoral membrane for those sensory information that's coming in. Okay, so it's kind of neat to think about. We got a few minutes. Okay. Chemoreceptors. Ah, so cool. And we'll do an experiment with that next week as well. Hopefully I'll remember to bring everything. Chemoreceptors are phenomenal. Taste, right? There's a book called Gulp. Anybody ever hear of a book called Gulp? If you want some free reading information, it's really quite neat. Gulp is about taste and about texture. So it's not just taste, it's texture. Some people don't like tomatoes, right, because of the gooey, the kind of the taste of it. They don't like it. And you think about, why is it that we make food the way we do, like cereal, a little crunchy? You don't like something slimy, right? You don't like something that's too gooey. Texture has such an important aspect for your appreciation of the food that you eat, or you won't eat it, or like kids won't eat things, right? Texture is really important. So there's actually a whole museum, a tasting and texture institute in the Netherlands. They actually look through all different foods and they let people taste them. It's the same food, but different textures. And they find out the best texture that you will like. It's not the taste, it's the texture of it. Isn't that wild? And you'll prefer a certain texture of food even though it tastes the same. That's pretty neat to think about. So think of the marketing, right? A lot of input on that. Chemosensory. You have chemosensory on your tongue. And you can actually do this. There's lots of high school or middle school science projects where they take Q-tips, right? They take a little vinegar and they touch on the tongue, or they may take sugar water and they touch on the tongue, and they find out where you're the most sensitive, right? For sugar receptors or sour receptors or different types of taste. And you can actually, maybe some of you did this in school where you actually taste the little piece of paper. It looks like pH paper. Did you ever do that? Right? And then you can actually find out, oh, I can't taste it, but why can my friend taste it? And then you take those papers home and you test your parents, and you find out one of them can't taste it too. That's kind of neat. Or if they both taste it, then you wonder about who your parents are. Okay. Right. So chemoreceptors are really phenomenal because of the sensitivity. Remember when we talked about to know a fly, Vincent Dettier? So he actually took flies, and on their legs, they have little hairs. He took a single hair with a little glass capillary tube, like you did for your intracellular recordings, but a little bit bigger, and he put different chemicals in there. And he could put it over the single hair and have the fly kind of hungry, and then all of a sudden the proboscis would come down, right? And if he did it just in water, it wouldn't really work, but he could actually test the different levels of sugar. And up to like 1 times 10 to the minus 9 molar of sugar, they could detect. They're more sensitive than you are for tasting sugar, for example. Amazing. So in that hair, on one leg, one hair has these sensory chemosensors that can actually detect sugar. Pretty amazing. So Vincent Dettier studied all that. And then that opened up a world to understand how we work, how other insects work. So it's really quite neat. So have fun this weekend. I'll try to get grades up by Monday, at least for Monday's class. I'm about Monday, so I'll have grades. We'll see you in lab on Monday for sections 1, 2, and 3.